When I get people to focus on a successful scenario of their project, they usually experience heightened enthusiasm and think of something unique and positive about it that hadn't occurred to them before. Wouldn't it be great if is not a bad way to start thinking about a situation, at least for long enough to have the option of getting an answer. Brainstorming. Once you know what you want to have happen and why, the how mechanism is brought into play. When you identify with some picture in your mind that is different from your current reality, you automatically start filling in the gaps or brainstorming. Ideas begin to pop into your head in somewhat random order. Little ones, big ones, not so good ones, good ones. This process usually goes on internally for most people about most things, and that's often sufficient. For example, you think about what you want to say to your boss as you're walking down the hall to speak to her. But there are many other instances when writing things down or capturing them in some external way can give a tremendous boost to productive output and thinking. Capturing your ideas. Over the last few decades, a number of graphics-oriented brainstorming techniques have been introduced to help develop creative thinking about projects and topics. They've been called things like mind mapping, clustering, patterning, webbing, and fishboning, although the authors of these various processes may portray them as being different from one another. For most of us end users, the basic premise remains the same. Give yourself permission to capture and express any idea, and then later on figure out how it fits in and what to do with it. If nothing else, and there is plenty of else, this practice adds to your efficiency. When you have the idea, you grab it, which means you won't have to go have the idea again. The most popular of these techniques is called mind mapping, a name coined by Tony Buzan, a British researcher in brain functioning, to label this process of brainstorming ideas into a graphic format. In mind mapping, the core idea is presented in the center, with associated ideas growing out in a somewhat free-form fashion around it. For instance, if I found out that I had to move my office, I might think about computers, changing my business cards, all the connections I'd have to change, new furniture, moving the phones, purging and packing, and so on. If I captured these thoughts graphically, it might start to look something like the mind map sample diagram in the PDF file included with this program. You could do this kind of mind mapping on post-its that could be stuck on a whiteboard, or you could input ideas into a word processor or outlining program on the computer. Distributed cognition. The great thing about external brainstorming is that in addition to capturing your original ideas, it can help generate many new ones that might not have occurred to you if you didn't have a mechanism to hold your thoughts and continually reflect them back to you. It's as if your mind were to say, look, I'm only going to give you as many ideas as you feel you can effectively use. If you're not collecting them in some trusted way, I won't give you that many. But if you're actually doing something with the ideas, even if it's just recording them for later evaluation, then here, have a bunch. And, oh, wow, that reminds me of another one, and another, etc. Psychologists are beginning to label this and similar processes distributed cognition. It's getting things out of your head and into objective, reviewable formats. But my English teacher in high school didn't have to know about the theory to give me the key. David, he said, you're going to college and you're going to be writing papers. Write all your notes and quotes on separate 3x5 cards. Then when you get ready to organize your thinking, just spread them all out on the floor, see the structure, and figure out what you're missing. Mr. Edmondson was teaching me a major piece of the natural planning model. Few people can hold their focus on a topic for more than a couple of minutes without some objective structure and tool or trigger to help them. Pick a big project you have going right now and just try to think of nothing else for more than 60 seconds. This is pretty hard to do unless you have a pen and paper in hand and use those cognitive artifacts as the anchor for your ideas. Then you can stay with it for hours. That's why good thinking can happen while you're working on a computer document about a project, mind mapping it on a legal pad, or on a paper tablecloth in a hip restaurant, or just having a meeting about it with other people in a room that allows you to hold the context. A whiteboard with a nice wet marker really helps there, too. Brainstorming keys. Many techniques can be used to facilitate brainstorming and out-of-the-box thinking. The basic principles, however, can be summed up as follows. Don't judge, challenge, evaluate, or criticize. Go for quantity, not quality. put analysis and organization in the background. Don't judge, challenge, evaluate, or criticize. It's easy for the unnatural planning model to rear its ugly head in brainstorming, making people jump to premature evaluations and critiques of ideas. If you care even slightly about what a critic thinks, you'll censure your expressive process as you look for the right thing to say. There's a very subtle distinction between keeping brainstorming on target with the topic and stifling the creative process. It's also important that brainstorming be put into the overall context of the planning process, because if you think that you're doing it just for its own sake, it can seem trite and inappropriately off course. If you can understand it instead as something you're doing right now for a certain period, before you move toward a resolution at the end, you'll feel more comfortable giving this part of the process its due. This is not to suggest that you should shut off critical thinking, though. Everything ought to be fair game at this stage. It's just wise to understand what kinds of thoughts you're having and to park them for use in the most appropriate way. The primary criterion must be expansion, not contraction. Go for quantity, not quality. Going for quantity keeps your thinking expansive. Often you won't know what's a good idea until you have it. And sometimes you'll realize it's a good idea or the germ of one only later on. You know how shopping at a big store with lots of options lets you feel comfortable about your choice? The same holds true for project thinking. The greater the volume of thoughts you have to work with, the better the context you can create for developing options and trusting your choices. Put analysis and organization in the background. Analysis and evaluation and organization of your thoughts should be given as free a rein as creative out-of-the-box thinking. But in the brainstorming phase, this critical activity should not be the driver. Making a list can be a creative thing to do, a way to consider the people who should be on your team, the customer requirements for the software, or the components of the business plan. Just make sure to grab all that and keep going until you get into the weeding and organizing of focus that make up the next stage. Organizing. If you've done a thorough job of emptying your head of all the things that came up in the brainstorming phase, you'll notice that a natural organization is emerging. As my high school English teacher suggested, once you get all the ideas out of your head and in front of your eyes, you'll automatically notice natural relationships and structure. This is what most people are referring to when they talk about project plans. Organizing usually happens when you identify components and subcomponents, sequences of events, and/or priorities. What are the things that must occur to create the final result? In what order must they occur? What is the most important element to ensure the success of the project? This is the stage in which you can make good use of structuring tools ranging from informal bullet points, scribbled literally on the back of an envelope, to project planning software like Microsoft Project. When a project calls for substantial objective control, you'll need some type of hierarchical outline with components and subcomponents, and/or a Gantt-type chart showing stages of the project laid out over time, with independent and dependent parts and milestones identified in relationship to the whole. Creative thinking doesn't stop here, it just takes another form. Once you perceive a basic structure, your mind will start trying to fill in the blanks. Identifying three key things that you need to handle on a project, for example, may cause you to think of a fourth and a fifth when you see them all lined up. The basics of organizing. The key steps here are, first, identify the significant pieces. Then, sort by one or more of these three factors: components, sequences, and/or priorities. And finally, detail to the required degree. I have never seen any two projects that needed to have exactly the same amount of structure and detail developed in order to get things off people's minds and moving successfully. But almost all projects can use some form of creative thinking from the left side of the brain along the lines of, what's the plan? Next actions. The final stage of planning comes down to decisions about the allocation and reallocation of physical resources to actually get the project moving. The question to ask here is, what's the next action? As we noted in the previous chapter, this kind of grounded, reality-based thinking, combined with clarification of the desired outcome, forms the critical component of knowledge work. In my experience, creating a list of what your real projects are and consistently managing your next action for each one will constitute 90% of what is generally thought of as project planning. This runway-level approach will make you honest about all kinds of things. Are you really serious about doing this? Who's responsible? Have you thought things through enough? At some point, if the project is an actionable one, this next action decision must be made. Answering the question about what specifically you would do about something physically if you had nothing else to do will test the maturity of your thinking about the project. If you're not yet ready to answer that question, you have more to flesh out at some prior level in the natural planning sequence. The basics. Decide on next actions for each of the current moving parts of the project. Decide on the next action in the planning process if necessary. Activating the moving parts. A project is sufficiently planned for implementation when every next action step has been decided on every front that can actually be moved on without some other components having to be completed first. If the project has multiple components, each of them should be assessed appropriately by asking, is there something that anyone could be doing on this right now? You could be coordinating speakers for the conference, for instance, at the same time that you're finding the appropriate site. In some cases, there will be only one aspect that can be activated, and everything else will depend on the results of that. So there may be only one next action, which will be the linchpin for all the rest. More to plan? What if there's still more planning to be done before you can feel comfortable with what's next? There's still an action step. It's just a process action. What's the next step in the continuation of planning? Drafting more ideas. Emailing Anna Maria and Sean to get their input. Telling your assistant to set up a planning meeting with the product team. The habit of clarifying the next action on projects, no matter what the situation, is fundamental to you staying in relaxed control. When the next action is someone else's. If the next action is not yours, you must nevertheless clarify whose it is. This is the primary use of the waiting for action list. In a group planning situation, it isn't necessary for everyone to know what the next step is on every part of the project. Often all that's required is to allocate responsibility for parts of the project to the appropriate persons and leave it up to them to identify next actions on their particular pieces. This next action conversation forces organizational clarity. Issues and details emerge that don't show up until someone holds everyone's feet to the fire about the physical level reality of resource allocation. It's a simple, practical discussion to foster, and one that can significantly stir the pot and identify weak links. How much planning do you really need to do? How much of this planning model do you really need to flesh out, and to what degree of detail? The simple answer is, as much as you need to get the project off your mind. In general, the reason things are on your mind is that the outcome and the action steps have not been appropriately defined, and/or reminders of them have not been put in places where you can be trusted to look for them appropriately. Additionally, you may not have developed the details, perspectives, and solutions sufficiently to trust the efficacy of your blueprint. Most projects, given my definition of a project as an outcome requiring more than one action, need no more than a listing of their outcome and next action for you to get them off your mind. You need a new stockbroker? You just have to call a friend for a recommendation. You want to set up a printer at home? You just need to surf the web to check out different models and prices. I estimate that 80% of projects are of that nature. You'll still be doing the full planning model on all of them, but only in your head, and just enough to figure out next actions and keep them going until they're complete. Another 15% or so of projects might require at least some external form of brainstorming, maybe a mind map or a few notes in a word processor or PowerPoint file. That might be sufficient for planning meeting agendas, your vacation, or a speech to a local chamber of commerce. A final 5% of projects might need the deliberate application of one or more of the five phases of the natural planning model. The model provides a practical recipe for unsticking things, resolving them, and moving them forward productively. Are you aware of a need for greater clarity or greater action on any of your projects? If so, using the model can often be the key to making effective progress. Need more clarity? If greater clarity is what you need, shift your thinking up the natural planning scale. People are often very busy at the action level, but nonetheless experience confusion and a lack of clear direction. they need to pull out their plan or create one, the organized level. If there's a lack of clarity at the planning level, there's probably a need for more brainstorming to generate a sufficient inventory of ideas to create trust in the plan. If the brainstorming session gets bogged down with fuzzy thinking, the focus should shift back to the vision of the outcome, ensuring that the reticular filter in the brain will open up to deliver the best how-to thinking. If the outcome vision is unclear, you must return to a clean analysis of why you're engaged in the situation in the first place, the purpose level. Need more to be happening? If more action is what's needed, you'll need to move down the model. There may be enthusiasm about the purpose of a project, but at the same time, some resistance to actually fleshing out what fulfilling it in the real world might look like. These days, the task of improving quality of work life may be on the radar for a manager, but often he won't yet have defined a clear picture of the desired result. The thinking must go to the specifics of the vision. Again, ask yourself, what would the outcome look like? If you've formulated an answer to that question, but things are still stuck, it's probably time for you to grapple with some of the how issues and the operational details and perspectives, brainstorming. I often have clients who have inherited a relatively clearly articulated project, like implement the new performance review system, but who aren't moving forward because they haven't yet taken a few minutes to dump some ideas out about what that might entail. If brainstorming gets hung up, and very often it does for more blue sky types, rigor may be required to do some evaluation of and decision-making about mission-critical deliverables that have to be handled, organizing. This is sometimes the case when an informal back-and-forth meeting that has generated lots of ideas ends without producing any decision about what actually needs to happen next on the project. And if there is a plan, but the rubber still isn't hitting the road like it should, someone needs to assess each component with the focus of what's the next action and who's got it. One manager, who had taken over responsibility many months in advance for organizing a major annual conference, asked me how to prevent the crisis all-nighters her team had experienced near the deadline the previous year. When she produced an outline of the various pieces of the project she'd inherited, I asked which pieces could actually be moved on right now. After identifying half a dozen, we clarified the next action on each one. It was off and running. In the last two chapters, I've covered the basic models of how to stay maximally productive and in control with minimal effort at the two most basic levels of our life and work, the actions we take and the projects we enter into that generate many of those actions. The fundamentals remain true. You must be responsible for collecting all your open loops, applying a front-end thought process to each of them, and managing the results with organization, review, and action. For all those situations that you have any level of commitment to complete, there is a natural planning process that goes on to get you from here to there. Leveraging that five-phase model can often make the evolution easier, faster, and more productive. These models are simple to understand and easy to implement. Applying them creates remarkable results. You need essentially no new skills. You already know how to write things down, clarify outcomes, decide next actions, put things into categories, review it all, and make intuitive choices. Right now, you have the ability to focus on successful results, brainstorm, organize your thinking, and get moving on your next steps. But just knowing how to do all of those things does not produce results. Merely having the ability to be highly productive, relaxed, and in control doesn't make you that way. If you're like most people, you can use a coach, someone to walk you step by step through the experience and provide some guideposts and handy tricks along the way until your new operational style is elegantly embedded. You'll find that in Part 2. Part 2, Practicing Stress-Free Productivity. Chapter 4, Getting Started, Setting Up the Time, Space, and Tools. In Part 2, we'll move from a conceptual framework and limited application of workflow mastery to full-scale implementation and best practices. Going through this program often gives people a level of relaxed control they may never have experienced before, but it usually requires the catalyst of step-by-step procedures to get there. To that end, I'll provide a logical sequence of things to do to make it as easy as possible for you to get on board and glean the most value from these techniques. Implementation, whether all out or casual, is a lot about tricks. If you're not sure you're committed to an all-out implementation of these methods, let me assure you that a lot of the value people get from this material is good tricks. Sometimes just one good trick can make it worthwhile to range through this information. I've had people tell me, for example, that the best thing they got from my 2-day seminar was advice on setting up and using a tickler file. Tricks are for the not-so-smart, not-so-conscious part of us. To a great degree, the highest performing people I know are those who have installed the best tricks in their lives. I know that's true of me. The smart part of us sets up things for us to do that the not-so-smart part responds to almost automatically, creating behavior that produces high-performance results. We trick ourselves into doing what we ought to be doing. For instance, if you're a semi-regular exerciser like me, you probably have your own little tricks to get you to exercise. My best trick is costume, the clothing I put on or take off. If I put on exercise gear, I'll start to feel like exercising. If I don't, I'm very likely to feel like doing something else. Let's look at an example of a real productivity trick. You've probably taken work home that you had to bring back the next day, right? It was mission critical that you not forget it the next morning. So, where did you put it the night before? Did you put it in front of the door or on your keys so you'd be sure to take it with you? For this, you got a higher education? What a sophisticated piece of self-management technology you've installed in your life. But actually, that's just what it is. The smart part of you the night before knows that the not-so-smart part of you first thing in the morning may barely be conscious. What's this in front of the door? Oh, that's right, I've got to take it with me. What a class act. But really, it is. It's a trick I call put it in front of the door. For our purposes, though, the door is going to be the door of your mind, not your house. But it's the same idea. If you were to take out your calendar right now and look closely at every single item for the next 14 days, you'd probably come up with at least one, oh, that reminds me, I need to. If you then captured that value-added thought into some place that would trigger you to act, you'd feel better already, have a clearer head, and get more positive things done. It's not rocket science, just a good trick. If you take out a clean sheet of paper right now, along with your favorite writing instrument, and for 3 minutes focus solely on the most awesome project on your mind, I guarantee you'll have at least one, oh yeah, I need to consider. Then capture what shows up in your head on the piece of paper and put it where you might actually use the idea or information. You won't be 1 ounce smarter than you were 10 minutes ago, but you'll have added value to your work and life. Much of learning how to manage workflow in a black belt way is about laying out the gear and practicing the moves so that the requisite thinking happens more automatically, and it's a lot easier to get engaged in the game. The suggestions that follow about getting time, space, and tools in place are all trusted methods for making things happen at a terrific new level. If you're sincere about making a major leap forward in your personal management systems, I recommend that you pay close attention to the details and follow through on the suggestions provided below in their entirety. The whole will be greater than the sum of the parts. You'll also discover that the execution of this program will produce real progress on real things that are going on in your life right now. We'll get lots done that you want to get done in new and efficient ways that may amaze you. Setting aside the time. I recommend that you create a block of time to initialize this process and prepare a workstation with the appropriate space, furniture, and tools. If your space is properly set up and streamlined, it can reduce your unconscious resistance to dealing with your stuff and even make it attractive for you to sit down and crank through your input and your work. An ideal time frame for most people is 2 whole days back to back. Don't be put off by that if you don't have that long to spend, though. Doing any of the activities I suggest will be useful no matter how much or how little time you devote to them. 2 days are not required to benefit from these techniques and principles. They will start to pay off almost instantly. Implementing the full collection process can take up to 6 hours or more. And processing and deciding on actions for all the input you'll want to externalize and capture into your system can easily take another 8 hours. Of course, you can also collect and process your stuff in chunks, but it'll be much easier if you can tackle that front-end portion in one fell swoop. The ideal time for me to work with a professional is on a weekend or holiday because the chance of outside disturbance is minimal then. If I work with someone on a typical workday, we first make sure that no meetings are scheduled and only emergency interruptions are allowed. Phone calls are routed to voicemail or logged by secretaries for review and handling during a break. I don't recommend using after hours for this work. It usually means seriously reduced horsepower and a big tendency to get caught up in rabbit trails. For many of the executives I work with, holding the world back for 2 contiguous days is the hardest part of the whole process. The perceived necessity to be constantly available for meetings and communications when they're at work is difficult for them to let go of. That's why we often resort to weekends. If you work in an open cubicle or office, it will be even more of a challenge to isolate sufficient time blocks on a regular workday during office hours. It's not that the procedure itself is so sacred. It's just that it takes a lot of psychic energy to collect and process such a large inventory of open loops, especially when they've been open, undecided, or stuck for way too long. Interruptions can double the time it takes to get through everything. If you can get to ground zero in one contained time period, it gives you a huge sense of control and accomplishment and frees up a reservoir of energy and creativity. Later on, you can maintain your system in shorter spurts around and between the lines of your regular day. Setting up the space. You'll need a physical location to serve as a central cockpit of control. If you already have a desk and office space set up where you work, that's probably the best place to start. If you work from a home office, obviously that will be your prime location. If you already have both, you'll want to establish identical, even interchangeable systems in both places. The basics for a workspace are just a writing surface and room for an in-basket. Some people, such as a foreman in a machine shop, an intake nurse on a hospital floor, or your children's nanny, won't need much more than that. The writing surface will, of course, expand for most professionals to include a phone, a computer, stacking trays, working file drawers, reference shelves. Some may feel the need for a fax, a printer, a VCR, and/or multimedia conferencing equipment. The seriously self-contained will also want gear for exercise, leisure, and hobbies. A functional workspace is critical. If you don't already have a dedicated workspace and in-basket, get them now. That goes for students, homemakers, and retirees too. Everyone must have a physical locus of control from which to deal with everything else. If I had to set up an emergency workstation in just a few minutes, I would buy a door, put it on top of 2 2-drawer filing cabinets, one at each end, place 3 stack baskets on it, and add a legal pad and a pen. That would be my home base. If I had time to sit down, I'd also buy a stool. Believe it or not, I've been in several executive offices that wouldn't be as functional. If you go to an office, you'll still need a space at home. Don't skimp on workspace at home. As you'll discover through this process, it's critical that you have at least a satellite home system identical to the one in your office. Many people I've worked with have been somewhat embarrassed by the degree of chaos that reigns in their homes in contrast to their offices at work. They've gotten tremendous value from giving themselves permission to establish the same setup in both places. If you're like many of them, you'll find that a weekend spent setting up a home workstation can make a revolutionary change in your ability to organize your life. An office space in transit. If you move around much, as a business traveler or just as a person with a mobile lifestyle, you'll also want to set up an efficiently organized micro office in transit. More than likely, this will consist of a briefcase, pack, or satchel with appropriate folders and portable workstation supplies. Many people lose opportunities to be productive because they're not equipped to take advantage of the odd moments and windows of time that open up as they move from one place to another, or when they're in off-site environments. The combination of a good processing style, the right tools, and good interconnected systems at home and at work can make traveling a highly leveraged way to get certain kinds of work done. Don't share space. It is imperative that you have your own workspace, or at least your own in-basket and a physical place in which to process paper. Too many married couples I've worked with have tried to work out of a single desk at home, and it always makes light years of difference when they expand to 2 workstations. Far from being the separation they expect, the move, in fact, relieves them of a subtle stress in their relationship about managing the stuff of their shared lives. One couple even decided to set up an additional mini workstation in the kitchen for the stay-at-home mom so she could process work while keeping an eye on their infant in the family room. Some organizations are interested in the concept of hoteling, That is, having people create totally self-contained and mobile workstation capabilities so they can plug in anywhere in the company at any time and work from there. I have my doubts about how well that concept will work in practice. A friend who was involved in setting up an Office of the Future model in Washington, D.C. for the U.S. government claimed that hoteling tended to fall apart because of the, quote, mine, unquote, factor. People wanted their own stuff. I suggest there's a deeper reason for the failure. There needs to be zero resistance at the less-than-conscious level for us to use the systems we have. Having to continually reinvent our in-basket, our filing system, and how and where we process our stuff can only be a source of incessant distraction. You can work virtually everywhere if you have a clean, compact system and know how to process your stuff rapidly and portably, but you'll still need a home base with a well-grooved set of tools and sufficient space for all the reference and support material that you'll want somewhere close at hand when you land. Most people I work with need at least 4 file drawers for their general reference and project support types of paper-based materials, and it's hard to imagine that all of that could ever be totally and easily movable. Getting the tools you'll need. If you're committed to a full implementation of this workflow process, there are some basic supplies and equipment that you'll need to get you started. As you go along, you're likely to dance between using what you're used to and evaluating the possibilities for new and different gear to work with. Note that good tools don't necessarily have to be expensive. Often, on the low-tech side, the more executive something looks, the more dysfunctional it really is. The basic processing tools. Let's assume you're starting from scratch. In addition to a desktop workspace, you'll need paper-holding trays, at least 3, a stack of plain letter-size paper, a pen or pencil, Post-its, 3x3s, paper clips, binder clips, a stapler and staples, Scotch tape, rubber bands, an automatic labeler, file folders, a calendar, wastebasket recycling bins. This list can be referred to in the PDF file included with this program. Paper holding trays. These will serve as your in-basket and out-basket, with 1 or 2 others for work-in-progress support papers and/or your read-and-review stack. The most functional trays are the side-facing letter or legal stackable kinds, which have no lip on them to keep you from sliding out a single piece of paper. Plain paper. You'll use plain paper for the initial collection process. Believe it or not, putting one thought on one full-size sheet of paper can have enormous value. Although most people will wind up processing their notes into some sort of list organizer, a few will actually stick with the simple piece of paper per thought system. In any case, it's important to have plenty of letter-sized writing paper or tablets around to make capturing ad hoc input easy. Post-its, clips, stapler, etc. Post-its, clips, stapler, tape, and rubber bands will come in handy for routing and storing paper-based materials. We're not finished with paper yet, if you haven't noticed, and the simple tools for managing it are essential. The labeler. The labeler is a surprisingly critical tool in our work. Thousands of executives and professionals and homemakers I've worked with now have their own automatic labelers, and my archives are full of their comments like, "Incredible, I wouldn't have believed what a difference it makes." The labeler will be used to label your file folders, binder spines, and numerous other things. At this writing, I recommend the Brother labeler. It's the most user-friendly. Get the least expensive one that sits on a desk and has an AC adapter so you won't have to worry about batteries. Also, get a large supply of cassettes of label tape. Black letters on white tape, instead of clear, are much easier to read and allow you to relabel folders you might want to reuse. You can get software and printer sheets to make computer-generated labels, but I prefer the standalone tool. If you have to wait to do your filing or labeling as a batch job, you'll most likely resist making files for single pieces of paper, and it'll add the formality factor, which really puts the brakes on this system. File folders. You'll need plenty of file folders. Get letter size if you can, legal if you must. You may also need an equal number of PendaFlex-style file folder hangers if your filing system requires them. Plain manila folders are fine. Color coding is a level of complexity that's hardly ever worth the effort. Your general reference filing system should just be a simple library. Calendar. Although you may not need a calendar just to collect your incomplete items, you'll certainly come up with actions that need to be put there too. As I noted earlier, the calendar should be used not to hold action lists, but to track the hard landscape of things that have to get done on a specific day or at a specific time. Most professionals these days already have some sort of working calendar system in place, ranging from pocket week-at-a-glance booklets to loose-leaf organizers with day, week, month, and year-at-a-glance options, to single-user software organizers, to groupware calendars used company-wide like Outlook or Lotus Notes. The calendar has often been the central tool that people rely on to get organized. It's certainly a critical component in managing particular kinds of data and reminders of the commitments that relate to specific times and days. There are many reminders and some data that you will want a calendar for, but you won't be stopping there. Your calendar will need to be integrated with a much more comprehensive system that will emerge as you apply this method. You may wonder what kind of calendar would be best for you to use, and I'll discuss that in more detail in the next chapter. For now, just keep using the one you've got. After you develop a feel for the whole systematic approach, you'll have a better reference point for deciding about graduating to a different tool. Wastebasket recycling bins. If you're like most people, you're going to toss a lot more stuff than you expect, so get ready to create a good bit of trash. Some executives I've coached have found it extremely useful to arrange for a large dumpster to be parked immediately outside their offices the day we work together. Do you need an organizer? Whether or not you'll need an organizer will depend on a number of factors. Are you already committed to using one? How do you want to see your reminders of actions, agendas, and projects? Where and how often might you need to review them? Because your head is not the place in which to hold things, you'll obviously need something to manage your triggers externally. You could maintain everything in a purely low-tech fashion by keeping pieces of paper in folders. Or you could even use a paper-based notebook or planner, or a digital version thereof. Or you could even employ some combination of these. All of the low-tech gear listed in the previous section is used for various aspects of collecting, processing, and organizing. You'll use a tray and random paper for collecting. As you process your in-basket, you'll complete many less than 2-minute actions that will require post-its, a stapler, and paper clips. The magazines, articles, and long memos that are your longer than 2-minute reading will go in another of the trays, and you'll probably have quite a bit just to file. What's left? Maintaining a project inventory, logging calendar items and action and agenda reminders, and tracking the things you're waiting for will require some form of lists or reviewable groupings of similar items. Lists can be managed simply in a low-tech way as pieces of paper kept in a file folder. For instance, separate sheets or notes for each person you need to call in a calls file. Or they can be arranged in a more mid-tech fashion in loose-leaf notebooks or planners, a page titled calls with the names listed down the sheet. Or they can be high-tech, digital versions of paper lists such as a calls category in the to-do section of a Palm PDA or in Microsoft Outlook Tasks. In addition to holding portable reference material, for example, telephone and address information, most organizers are designed for managing lists. Your calendar is actually a form of a list, with time and day-specific action reminders listed chronologically. Probably thousands of types of organizers have been on the market since the 1980s, from the early rash of pocket day timers to the current flood of high-tech personal digital assistants and PC-based software products like Microsoft Outlook and Lotus Notes. Should you implement the Getting Things Done process into what you're currently using, or should you install something new? The answer is, do whichever one will actually help you change your behavior so you'll use the tools appropriately. There are efficiency factors to consider here, too. Do you get a lot of digital information that would be easier to track with a digital tool? Do you need a paper-based calendar for all the appointments you have to make and change rapidly on the run? Do you need reminders of things like calls you have to make when it's not easy to carry file folders? And so on. There are also the aesthetic and enjoyment factors. I've done some of my best planning and updating for myself when I simply wanted some excuse to use, that is, to play with, my organizer while waiting for dinner in a restaurant. When considering whether to get and use an organizer, and if so, which one, keep in mind that all you really need to do is manage lists. You've got to be able to create a list on the run and review it easily and as regularly as you need to. Once you know what to put on the list and how to use them, the medium really doesn't matter. Just go for simplicity, speed, and fun. The critical factor of a filing system. A simple and highly functional personal reference system is critical to this process. The filing system at hand is the first thing I assess before beginning the workflow process in anyone's office. As I noted in Chapter 2, the lack of a good general reference system can be one of the greatest obstacles to implementing a personal management system. And for most of the executives I've personally coached, it represents one of the biggest opportunities for improvement. Many times I've driven to the local office supply store with a client and bought a filing cabinet, a big stock of file folders, and a labeler just so we could create an appropriate place in which to put two-thirds of the stuff lying around his or her desk and credenza and even on the office floors. We're concerned here mostly with general reference filing, as distinct from discrete filing systems devoted to contracts, financial information, or other categories of data that deserve their own place in indexing. General reference files should hold articles, brochures, pieces of paper, notes, printouts, faxes, basically anything that you want to keep for its interesting or useful data and that doesn't fit into your specialized filing systems and won't stand up by itself on a shelf, as will large software manuals and seminar binders. If you have a trusted secretary or assistant who maintains that system for you, so you can put a file as X post-it on the document and send it out to him or her, great. But ask yourself if you still have some personally interesting or confidential support material that should be accessible at any moment, even when your assistant isn't around. If so, you'll still need your own system, either in your desk or right beside it somewhere. Success factors for filing. I strongly suggest that you maintain your own personal at-hand filing system. It should take you less than 1 minute to pick something up out of your in-basket or print it from email, decide it needs no action but has some potential future value, and finish storing it in a trusted system. If it takes you longer than a minute to complete that sequence of actions, you have a significant improvement opportunity since you probably won't file the document. You'll stack it or stuff it instead. Besides being fast, the system needs to be fun and easy, current and complete. Otherwise, you'll unconsciously resist emptying your in-basket because you know there's likely to be something in there that ought to get filed, and you won't even want to look at the papers. Take heart. I've seen people go from resisting to actually enjoying sorting through their stacks once their personal filing system is set up and humming. You must feel equally comfortable about filing a single piece of paper on a new topic, even a scribbled note, in its own file, as you would about filing a more formal, larger document. Because it requires so much work to make and organize files, people either don't keep them or have junked up cabinets and drawers full of all sorts of one-of-a-kind items, like a menu for the local takeout cafe or the current train schedule. Whatever you need to do to get your reference system to that quick and easy standard for everything it has to hold, do it. My system works wonderfully for me and for many others who try it, and I highly recommend that you consider incorporating all of the following guidelines to really make reference filing automatic. Keep your general reference files at hand's reach. Filing has to be instantaneous and easy. If you have to get up every time you have some ad hoc piece of paper you want to file, you'll tend to stack it instead of filing it. And you're also likely to just resist the whole in-basket process because you subconsciously know there's stuff in there that might need filing. Many people I have coached have redesigned their office space so they have four general reference file drawers literally in swivel distance instead of across their room. One alpha system. I have one A to Z alphabetical filing system, not multiple systems. People have a tendency to want to use their files as a personal organization system, and therefore they attempt to organize them by projects or areas of focus. This magnifies geometrically the number of places something isn't when you forget where you filed it. One simple alpha system files everything by topic, project, person, or company, so it can be in only three or four places if you forget exactly where you put it. You can usually put at least one subset of topics on each label, like gardening-pots and gardening-ideas. These could be filed under G. Currently, I have four file drawers for my general reference files, and each is clearly marked on the outside, A to E, F to L, and so forth, so I don't have to think about where something goes once it's labeled. Every once in a while, someone has such a huge amount of reference material on one topic or project that it should be put in its own discrete drawer or cabinet. But if it is less than half a file drawer's worth, I recommend including it in the single general alphabetical system. Have lots of fresh folders. I keep a giant stack of fresh, new file folders instantly at hand and reachable from where I sit to process my in-basket. Nothing is worse than having something to file and not having an abundance of folders to grab from to make the process easy. At any given time, I want to have an inventory of almost half a file drawer full of unused or reusable folders. Rule of thumb, reorder when the number drops below 100. Keep the drawer less than 3/4 full. Always try to keep your file drawers less than 3/4 full. If they're stuffed, you'll unconsciously resist putting things in there, and reference materials will tend to stack up instead. If a drawer is starting to get tight, I may purge it while I'm on hold on the phone. I know almost no one who doesn't have overstuffed file drawers. If you value your cuticles and if you want to get rid of your unconscious resistance to filing, then you must keep your drawers loose enough that you can insert and retrieve files without effort. Some people's reaction to this is, I'd have to buy more file cabinets, as if that were something horrible. Help me out here. If the stuff is worth keeping, it's worth keeping so that it's easily accessible, right? And if it's not, then why are you keeping it? It's said that we're in the information age. If there's any validity to that, and if you're doing anything that hinders your usage of it, not smart. You may need to create another tier of reference storage to give yourself sufficient working room with your general reference files at hand. Materials such as finished project notes and dead client files may still need to be kept, but can be stored off-site or at least out of your workspace. Label your file folders with an auto-labeler. Typeset labels change the nature of your files and your relationship to them. Labeled files feel comfortable on a boardroom table. Everyone can identify them. You can easily see what they are from a distance and in your briefcase. And when you open your file drawers, you get to see what looks almost like a printed index of your files in alphabetical order. It makes it fun to open the drawer to find or insert things. Perhaps later in this new millennium, the brain scientists will give us some esoteric and complex neurological explanation for why labeled files work so effectively. Until then, trust me, get a labeler and get your own. To make the whole system work without a hitch, you'll need to have it at hand all the time so you can file something whenever you want. And don't share. If you have something to file and your labeler's not there, you'll just stack the material instead of filing it. The labeler should be as basic a tool as your stapler. Get high-quality mechanics. File cabinets are not the place to skimp on quality. Nothing is worse than trying to open a heavy file drawer and hearing that awful screech that happens when you wrestle with the roller bearings on one of those $29.95 special sale cabinets. You really need a file cabinet whose drawer, even when it's 3/4 full, will glide open and click shut with the smoothness and solidity of a door on a German car. I'm not kidding. Get rid of hanging files if you can. At the risk of seriously offending a lot of people who are already using hanging files, I recommend that you totally do away with the hanging file hardware and use just plain folders standing up by themselves in the file drawer, held up by the movable metal plate in the back. Hanging folders are much less efficient because of the effort it takes to make a new file ad hoc and the formality that imposes on the filing system. Here's an email I received recently from a senior manager who actually took my advice after avoiding it for a couple of years because of his investment in the hanging hardware. "Your system is fantastic. I've completely redone my files at home and at work. It only took a combined 4 days to do it, but I've done away with Pendaflex and have gone to the Manila folder system with A to Z and nothing else. Wow, it's so much easier. My desk, for some reason, is a lot neater, too, without those stacks of to-be-filed stuff hanging around." But if you can't. Many people are stuck with a hanging file system, at least at work, because side-opening hanger folder filing cabinets have become standard corporate issue. If you have to work with hanging files, then I recommend that you label the files, not the hanger. That lets you carry the file folders for meetings and when traveling without taking the hanger. Use only one file folder per hanger. This will keep the drawer visually neat and prevent the weirdness that results when multiple files make a hanger uneven. Having to recalibrate files in an alpha system every time a folder gets full is too much trouble. Keep a big supply of plain hangers and new file folders in the front of your first file drawer so you can make new files and store them in a flash. Purge your files at least once a year. Cleaning house in your files regularly keeps them from going stale and seeming like a black hole, and it also gives you the freedom of keeping anything on a whim in case you might need it. You know everything will be reassessed within a few months anyway, and you can redecide then what's worth keeping and what isn't. As I say, I purge my files while I'm on hold on the phone or marking time on a conference call that's dragging on and on. I recommend that all organizations, if they don't have one already, establish a dumpster day when all employees get to come to work in sneakers and jeans, put their phones on Do Not Disturb, and get current with all their stored stuff. Dumpsters are brought in, and everyone has permission to spend the whole day in purge mode. A personal dumpster day is an ideal thing to put into your Tickler file, either during the holidays at year's end or around early spring tax preparation time when you might want to tie it in with archiving the previous year's financial files. One final thing to prepare. You've blocked off some time, you've gotten a work area set up, and you've got the basic tools to start implementing the methodology. Now what? If you've decided to commit a certain amount of time to setting up your workflow system, there's one more thing that you'll need to do to make it maximally effective. You must clear the decks of any other commitments for the duration of the session. If there's someone you absolutely need to call, or something your secretary has to handle for you, or you have to check with your spouse about, do it now. Or make an agreement with yourself about when you will do it, and then put some reminder of that where you won't miss it. It's critical that your full psychic attention be available for the work at hand. Almost without exception, when I sit down to begin coaching people, even though they blocked out time and committed significant money to utilize me as a resource for that time, they still have things they're going to have to do before we quit for the day, and they haven't arranged for them yet in their own systems. "Oh yeah, I've got to call this client back sometime today," they'll say, or "I have to check in with my spouse to see if he's gotten the tickets for tonight." It bespeaks a certain lack of awareness and maturity in our culture, I think, that so many sophisticated people are ignoring those levels of responsibility to their own psyche on an ongoing operational basis. So, have you handled all that? Good. Now it's time to gather representatives of all your open loops into one place. Chapter 5. Collection. Corralling your stuff. In Chapter 2, I described the basic procedures for collecting your work. This chapter will lead you in more detail through the process of getting all your incompletes, all your stuff, into one place, into N. That's the critical first step in getting to the state of mind like water. Just gathering a few more things than you currently have will probably create a positive feeling for you. But if you can hang in there and really do the whole collection process 100%, it will change your experience dramatically and give you an important new reference point for being on top of your work. When I coach a client through this process, the collection phase usually takes between 1 and 6 hours, though it did take all of 20 hours with one person. Finally, I just told him, you know, you get the idea. It can take longer than you think if you're committed to a full-blown capture that will include everything at work and everywhere else. That means going through every storage area and every nook and cranny in every location, including cars, boats, and other homes if you have them. Be assured that if you give yourself at least a couple of hours to tackle this part, you can grab the major portion of things outstanding, and you can even capture the rest by creating relevant placeholding notes. For example, purge and process boat storage shed, and deal with the hall closet. In the real world, you probably won't be able to keep your stuff 100% collected all the time. If you're like most people, you'll move too fast and be engaged in too many things during the course of a week to get all your ideas and commitments captured outside your head. but it should become an ideal standard that keeps you motivated to consistently clean house of all the things about your work and life that have your attention. Ready, set. There are very practical reasons to gather everything before you start processing it. First, it's helpful to have a sense of the volume of stuff you have to deal with. Second, it lets you know where the end of the tunnel is. And third, when you're processing and organizing, you don't want to be distracted psychologically by an amorphous mass of stuff that might still be somewhere. Once you have all the things that require your attention gathered in one place, you'll automatically be operating from a state of enhanced focus and control. It can be daunting to capture into one location at one time all the things that don't belong where they are. It may even seem a little counterintuitive because, for the most part, most of that stuff was not and is not that important. That's why it's still lying around. It wasn't an urgent thing when it first showed up, and probably nothing's blown up yet because it hasn't been dealt with. It's the business card you put in your wallet of somebody you thought you might want to contact sometime. It's the little piece of techno gear in the bottom desk drawer that you're missing a part for. It's the printer that you keep telling yourself you're going to move to a better location in your office. These are the kinds of things that nag at you, but that you haven't decided either to deal with or to drop entirely from your list of open loops. But because you think there still could be something important in there, that stuff is controlling you and taking up more psychic energy than it deserves. Keep in mind, you can feel good about what you're not doing only when you know what you're not doing. So, it's time to begin. Grab your in basket and a half-inch stack of plain paper for your notes, and let's go. Physical gathering. The first activity is to search your physical environment for anything that doesn't belong where it is, the way it is, permanently, and put it into your in basket. You'll be gathering things that are incomplete, things that have some decision about potential action tied to them. They all go into in, so they'll be available for later processing. What stays where it is? The best way to create a clean decision about whether something should go into the in basket is to understand clearly what shouldn't go in. Here are the four categories of things that can remain where they are, the way they are, with no action tied to them. Supplies, reference material, decoration, equipment. Supplies include anything you need to keep because you use it regularly. Stationery, business cards, stamps, staples, post-it pads, legal pads, paper clips, ballpoint refills, batteries, forms you need to fill out from time to time, rubber bands, all of these qualify. Many people also have a personal supplies drawer at work containing dental floss, Kleenex, breath mints, and so on. Reference material is anything you simply keep for information as needed, such as manuals for your software, the local takeout deli menu, or your kid's soccer schedule. This category includes your telephone and address information, any material relevant to projects, themes, and topics, and sources such as dictionaries, encyclopedias, and almanacs. Decoration means pictures of family, artwork, and fun and inspiring things pinned to your bulletin board. You also might have plaques, mementos, and/or plants. Equipment is obviously the telephone, computer, fax, printer, wastebasket, furniture, and/or VCR. You no doubt have a lot of things that fall into these four categories. Basically, all your tools and your gear, which have no actions tied to them. Everything else goes into in. But many of the things you might initially interpret as supplies, reference, decoration, or equipment could also have action associated with them because they still aren't exactly the way they need to be. For instance, most people have in their desk drawers and on their credenzas and bulletin boards a lot of reference materials that either are out of date or need to be organized somewhere else. Those should go into in. Likewise, if your supplies drawer is out of control, full of lots of dead or unorganized stuff, that's an incomplete that needs to be captured. Are the photos of your kids current ones? Is the artwork what you want on the wall? Are the mementos really something you still want to keep? Is the furniture precisely the way it should be? Is the computer set up the way you want it? Are the plants in your office alive? In other words, supplies, reference materials, decoration, and equipment may need to be tossed into the end basket if they're not just where they should be, the way they should be. Issues about collecting. As you engage in the collecting phase, you may run into one or more of the following. You've got a lot more than will fit into one end basket. You're likely to get derailed into purging and organizing. You may have some form of stuff already collected and organized, and/or you're likely to run across some critical things that you want to keep in front of you. What if an item is too big to go in the end basket? If you can't physically put something in the end basket, then write a note on a piece of letter-sized plain paper to represent it. For instance, if you have a poster or other piece of artwork behind the door to your office, just write "artwork behind door" on a letter-sized piece of paper and put the paper in the end basket. Be sure to date it, too. This has a couple of benefits. If your organization system winds up containing some of these pieces of paper representing something else, it'll be useful to know when the note was created. It's also just a great habit to date everything you handwrite, from post-it notes to your assistant, to voicemails you download onto a pad, to notes you take on a phone call with a client. The 3% of the time that this little piece of information will be extremely useful makes it worth developing the habit. What if the pile is too big to fit into the end basket?